for this movement doesn't negate how risky supporting divestment was or the actual consequences it had for the people involved. Enter A Different World Season 3, Episode 16, the one where the students are debating whether Hillman should divest. And of course, it seemed like a no-brainer at first, until it meant Kim, like many other students, would have to lose their jobs and their scholarships. Ooh, well, child. The episode aired in 1989, right in the thick of what was going on in the motherland. And while it was putting a hurt on the South African government for sure, it was also affecting the victims of apartheid in South Africa themselves, because it also affected their places of work and their ability to make money.
Goodness gracious, I say.
Now, Nelson Mandela joined the fight since the 1940s and had become a prominent leader by the 1950s. And while the movement had its peaceful beginnings, the apartheid regime responded violently, which prompted Mandela to establish an underground armed resistance group called the Spear of the Nation, or MK. And he was eventually arrested for these underground efforts in 1962 and was sentenced to life in prison in 1963. Mandela remained in prison for the next 27 years, and despite immense public pressure, he would not be released until apartheid ended in the 1990s. Meanwhile, even though American divestment numbers showed the U.S. was anti-apartheid, somehow Mandela stayed on our government's terrorist list till 2008. Make it make sense. Our government? Make sense? Have you seen how they're behaving outside right now? Girl, I don't think they're allowed to make sense. But wait, there's more. The parking lot will be ending early this year.
What?
I know. But why? Because I think it's time for me to stop running my mouth on the internet and come see y'all in person. Ha! Your girl going on tour. Celebration. Ooh. I'm coming to a city near you. If you are in New York, if you are in D.C., if you are in Houston, if you're in Atlanta, if you're in L.A., beginning in December, I'm coming to see you. Tickets on sale next Friday. See y'all soon.
Sometimes in this journalism business, it is hard to get the words exactly right, particularly in a situation that is complex and layered, which evokes so much deep emotion and conflict, and where people's lives are literally at stake. And given how brittle the feelings are, to the point where many Americans are afraid to say anything at all, we should be able to agree on a few fundamentals. First, that it is wrong to kill children. Whether they are Israeli children or Palestinian children, it is wrong to kill kids in a concert field or in a kibbutz or in a hospital. In fact, it is morally repugnant. If we can't agree on that, then we can't be friends. We should also agree that anti-Semitism is wrong, full stop, period. And it should horrify everyone that we're seeing attacks against Jewish people here and abroad, like the online messages threatening violence against Jewish students at Cornell University, or the anti-Semitic mob that stormed an airport tarmac in Russia, apparently searching for Jewish passengers on a flight from Israel, or the Heil Hitler message projected on an interstate overpass in Georgia. None of this is okay, needless to say. And no matter how you feel about the government in Israel and what that government does, that is not an excuse to take out your anger on individual Jewish people, whether they're Americans or Israelis or British or random passengers on a plane. Keep in mind, some of your strongest allies in your outrage on behalf of Palestinians are Jewish. They are protesting beside you and getting arrested with you at those protests. And many of them are walking around in shock and horror and fear right now because of October 7th, worrying about their families and wondering who their friends are. Likewise, you can't judge every Palestinian or every Muslim or every Arab based on what Hamas did any more than you could have judged every American by the fact that some Americans elected a religious extremist, an religious extremist-backed wannabe autocrat, and now multiple indicted criminal whose MAGA movement tried to violently overthrow the government and still might. And again, it should be needless to say, being for Palestinians' freedom and staying alive does not mean you love Hamas or support them. The Hamas attack killed an estimated 1,400 people, including children, according to Israeli authorities. And as of tonight, the death toll in Gaza has topped 8,000 since October 7th, including 3,400 children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. President Biden may say he doesn't believe Palestinians when they say how many of them have been killed. But reporting by news organizations like the AP, Reuters, the BBC, and our own reporters on the ground make it clear that the numbers of dead and the devastation in Gaza are staggering. The internet and some electricity have been turned back on, at least for now. And journalists and people in Gaza are still getting pictures out. So we can see with our own eyes that the situation is dire. And the violence goes beyond bombs. The U.S. is warning Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to rein in extremist settlers in the occupied West Bank in the wake of reports of violence against Palestinians there. According to the Associated Press, a Jewish settler shot and killed a Palestinian man who was harvesting olives near the West Bank city of Nablus. This means at least 7 Palestinians have been killed by settlers since the latest violence broke out more than 3 weeks ago. With that as a backdrop, Netanyahu gave a war speech over the weekend that can only be described as a religious call to arms, citing a biblical reference when saying, quote, "You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our holy Bible," unquote. Now, for those not familiar with the biblical term Amalek, here is the relevant quotation from 1 Samuel 15:3. "Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." Which does not sound like self-defense. Frankly, it sounds a lot more like a call for genocide. Israeli jets have bombarded not just northern Gaza, but southern Gaza too, despite Israeli officials calling on the 2 million displaced Palestinians to flee south. And given these bombings are being done using our tax dollars, perhaps we should ask some questions. For example, how does bombing a densely populated land strip filled 50% with children constitute self-defense? How does bombing hospitals, churches, mosques, and UN schools constitute self-defense? Well, you say, if Hamas fighters are hiding in the hospital using the civilians as human shields, okay, let's say they are. Are you arguing that flattening the hospital and killing newborns in their incubators and their moms in the NICU, cancer patients, someone with a broken leg, the doctors, nurses, and just the women and kids hiding in the hospital, that that's not a war crime? Because you would be wrong, according to international law. Well, why don't the people in Gaza just turn over Hamas militants to the Israelis? Okay, how do you propose they do that? Hamas is the de facto government in Gaza, and they're the ones with the guns. The leaders of Hamas aren't even in Gaza. And if they were, if you were a teenager living in an open-air prison, getting bombed day and night by, let's say, Mexico, and Mexican police kicked in the door and raided your house anytime they wanted and turned off the water and cut off your food, what are you going to do? Side with them? Help them while you're dying? That's like asking why Black folks don't help or trust the police. Okay, but after 9/11, we bombed Afghanistan in self-defense. Yeah, we did. And did that put an end to Al-Qaeda or get bin Laden? No, it did not. Because like Hamas, bin Laden wasn't in the country we were bombing. President Obama got him 10 years later in Pakistan using special forces and without bombing scores of kids to death. Bombing Afghanistan did buy us a 20-year occupation that got us more enemies in the Muslim world when we scooped people up on the battlefield and dragged them off to Gitmo. And when we threw in a gratuitous war against Iraq based on lies by a Bush administration that traded on our anger and our fear, the world rose up against us as we committed torture and tossed former Iraqi police and soldiers into makeshift gulags, and those prisoners later turned into ISIS. Oh, and the Taliban are back in control of Afghanistan. So again, what is the goal of mass bombing Gaza? Is it to find the people Hamas militants abducted on October 7? Okay, how? By flattening whatever shelter they're taking from the bombs? Don't you risk killing them all by bombing them with the Palestinians? Just some relevant questions. And trust me, people do want answers. Over the weekend, protests erupted around the world with hundreds of thousands of demonstrators rallying in cities in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, Copenhagen, Rome, Stockholm, Kuala Lumpur. Scores took to the streets in the U.S., shutting down the Brooklyn Bridge in New York and a major highway in San Francisco. The call in each of these protests was for a ceasefire, a word that for some has somehow come to mean anti-Semitism and a lack of care about those who were brutally killed on October 7th, or even support for Hamas. So how then do you explain the family members of some of those being held by Hamas who are also calling for a ceasefire? And what would a ceasefire even mean? Well, it would literally mean both sides stop shooting. No more rockets into Israel, no more Israeli jets strafing Gaza. It would mean a prisoner swap negotiated by credible third parties, which sadly probably doesn't include us at this point. It would mean getting food, water, and medicine into Gaza and not pushing for 2 million Palestinians to expel themselves to Egypt or Jordan, likely to never be allowed to return. Hopefully, it would mean tamping down the McCarthyism and the doxing and anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism in our own country and in Europe. And then somebody, anybody, actually working to solve the real problem, which is a 56-year occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip that has sparked and will continue to spark vehement, and yes, even violent resistance, whether Hamas exists or not. It's a lot to unpack, and sometimes it feels like an impossible conversation. But we need to have it anyway, today, tomorrow, and in the many days ahead. Today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a ceasefire will not happen in his latest speech, pointed at an international audience. What that means for the region, the U.S., and the world.
Thank you to Joy Reid and also to Lene. And we'll look forward to seeing Lene when she comes to Pittsburgh. That should be quite an experience. And in our last segment, let's go back and review some of the things that were said.
You're saying the city and county need to step it up right now.
I think the city and county need to come together and step it up. And I know they are working together, but we need to step it up.
The surge in homelessness and homeless encampments. We've shown you new tent villages popping up along the riverfronts and local parks. The city and county call it a long-term problem that requires long-term solutions. But tonight, some city council members are calling for more immediate action. KDK investigator Andy Sheehan first told you about the surge and joins us now live.
Homeless encampments have sprung up around the waterfronts and throughout the city, and city residents are concerned about their own safety and the safety of the homeless themselves. And some city council members are calling for immediate action. Underneath the Warhol Bridge, a homeless encampment seems to have sprung up overnight. And by day, many of those tent dwellers now congregate up above on the Fort Duquesne Boulevard promenade. These are homeless people mostly behind us?
Yes, sir. For most part, most of them are homeless.
The city and county say they're working with these people, trying to provide for their needs while attempting to get them into some kind of permanent housing. Since the pace is slow, some of the organizations have even provided the tents. But Council President Teresa Kale Smith calls this misguided and wants immediate action.
We're not helping people. We're creating more victims. And that's not the answer. We need some immediate response from both the county and the city to come together and work this out immediately.
Smith is being joined by Councilwoman Deb Gross and Councilman Bobby Wilson and asking both the city and county to address the crisis in the short term, like finding an empty hotel or assembling tiny house villages in which to place these people for the benefit of the general public and the homeless themselves.
We need to give the people that are homeless, that are without housing, and people that are living in and around this some relief. We need some relief immediately.
The city believes relief will come when this new shelter, currently under construction, opens up downtown, providing at least temporary shelter for many of the new homeless. But while Smith and others say more housing is needed, Mayor Ganey says removing the tents is not an option.
Remove them by force? I'm not going to remove them by force. We're going to try to do something that's a little bit more humane.
I would like to see the tents removed. And, I mean, there's a way to do it with some compassion. I think I would like to see the tents removed, but more importantly, I'd like to see the people into safe housing.
Finding that housing will be a tall order, but city council members say this is a crisis and it demands bold and immediate action. Reporting on the North Shore, Andy Sheehan, KDK News.
Thanks for listening. Coming up is consolidation, and on Sundays, it's the Jazz Corner. WRCT Pittsburgh.
Bright sign somewhere. There's a bright sign somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's a bright sign somewhere. There's more joy somewhere. There's more joy somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's more joy somewhere. And there's more peace There's more peace somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's more peace somewhere. There's more love somewhere. Let's not rest until we find it. There's more love somewhere.
Tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. It's time for another edition of Pandemonium here. It's been a pretty new show. Been going for a few weeks now. Basically, DJs just do whatever they want to do. My name's Bill. I normally do a heavy metal show on Sunday nights called To Evil Have a Human Name. But I'm also very interested in bagpiping. I've been playing myself for a few years. And CMU obviously has a big history of piping. And today on our episode, I have Andrew Carlisle, who's the director of piping here. He's going to talk a little bit about himself and his position and CMU and play a few tunes for us. Welcome to the show, Andy. How long have you been here at CMU for?
Oh, hello, Bill. Yeah, I've been in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon now for almost 12 years, just coming up to the end of the 12th year yet.
Yeah, and how did that all happen? Where did you start out and how did you end up here?
Oh, I'm originally from a small village in Northern Ireland called Ballygowan. And when I was 7 years old, I took up the instrument, the bagpipe. And yeah, just kind of took it from there. Ended up, you know, studying with some of the great players in both Ireland and Scotland. And then played with some various bands across the water. And then I was kind of finishing up grad school, and the job at Carnegie Mellon was posted, so I just applied for it, and here I am, I guess, 12 years later, yeah. So 2010 is when I started.
All right, and it's now 2022. You've been obviously enjoying your time here. You really enjoy the piping program here at CMU. Do you think it's up there with other places in the world?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was actually the first in the world to offer a degree in piping and also the first to offer a master's. And yeah, it's a terrific institution here. We've got a really good program and a really good student body. The degree program is actually quite small, being that you have to be a very high standard to be admitted to it. But we also have a lot of non-music majors that play the pipes that come for lessons and play in the band, and we also have the opportunity for first year students to, you know, just learn the instrument from scratch, you know. So I do a lot of teaching beginners as well here.
And do you get a lot of those kind of students that seem to really, you know, stick with it, or do you get a lot of people that just come in and the oddity of it, maybe, since you don't have as much piping as back home?
I mean with any musical instrument, there's quite a big commitment as to like learning it and, you know, sticking with it and practicing. And sometimes you do get some people that, get excited by it, but you know, when they start their academic studies in computer science or biology or whatever it may be, it gets a bit too much and they give it up. But the vast majority do stick with it. I would say there's at least maybe an 80% retention rate from people who start out to, you know, versus people that, you know, don't stick with it kind of thing on the beginner front. Yeah, and I get students from all over the world. You know, I've had them from pretty much every continent, aside from Antarctica, I guess, yeah.
Maybe someday. And obviously there's the CMU band, which is pretty active. I'm doing a lot of different events. You'll be doing the graduation ceremony soon.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we've got a pretty good pipe band here. It's, I mean, the last time the American Pipe Band Championships were held in 2019, pre-pandemic, Carnegie Mellon won. So a pretty high standard of pipe band. And yeah, it's very active in the greater Pittsburgh community. We just finished up a series of five concerts with River City Brass Band. A series called Celtic Connections. We'll be playing at commencement. We just played a couple of weeks ago at CMU's Spring Carnival. We're at the St. Patrick's Day Parade downtown in Pittsburgh. So, yeah, we're pretty active in the community as well.
And then you're also involved with the Pittsburgh Piping Society here, which is something that you and a few other pipers started a few years ago. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago now that we started it. So, basically, there were a lot of bagpipers in Pittsburgh, and a lot of them seemed to live in apartments or condos and things like that that they couldn't practice, or they didn't have very many opportunities that they could go and either play with other pipers or play in front of other pipers. So we kind of just formed this as a kind of social club, and basically the format is it's kind of like an open mic night for bagpipers. So if you want to come and have a tune in front of a supportive, friendly environment, you know, it's a perfect place for people to come along. And we've had it in various different venues throughout the city over the years. But, with the average kind of crowd we usually get is about 60 people, I think.
And it's based on some earlier piping societies, correct, including one here in the Pittsburgh area?
That's right, yeah. Unknown to me, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpipe Society, PBS. I'm not sure if they copyrighted the initials or not back then, but yeah, in the late 1800s, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpiping Society. I don't know too much about it, but I've seen records that it definitely existed. It must have kind of, you know, stopped existing at some point in the early 1900s. But yeah, thankfully in the kind of 2000s, I guess, we resurrected it, yeah. And yeah, it's pretty thriving. We just had an evening there last Friday evening in Squirrel Hill, and with a very good turnout, and with at least maybe a dozen pipers that played in that evening, yeah.
If there's anyone listening right now that's not really knowledgeable at bagpiping or anything like that, where should they check? Just check the website for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, Pittsburgh Piping Society will have a Facebook page, and I believe the website's currently under construction, but yeah, we do have a website. But yeah, the Facebook page is pretty active as to like when the next gathering or meeting or performance is going to be.
All right, great. Well, let's get into some music. You mind playing a few tunes for us?
Yeah, sure.
Up first, you're going to play March Strathspey and Reel. You want to tell us a little bit about those tunes real quick before
sure.
you go?
Sure. Well, a march just being real. So first of all, it's a march. So quite from the Scottish military tradition. And the march I'm going to play is The Braes of Castle Grant. The first two parts of it are traditional, and the third and fourth parts were added by a great piper called George Stuart MacLennan. A strathspey is a type of Highland dance. The Highland Fling is the dance that goes to the strathspey. And the strathspey I'm going to play is called Inverary Castle. And the reel is a traditional reel, just a different type of Scottish dance, a Scottish reel. And the reel is entitled The Rejected Suitor.
All right, great. Well, let's get right into it.
Thank you.
All right, Andy, that was great. What do you got next? Hopefully it's something maybe, you know, a little faster, a little more party atmosphere.
Sure. Well, how about a hornpipe and jig?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, so I'll try a hornpipe and jig, which is, yeah, two of the more lively dances in the Scottish repertoire. The hornpipe's called Jim Tweedy Sea Legs, and it was composed by a New Zealander called John Alan McGee.
That sounds like a very New Zealand type name.
I guess. Well, it's got five parts in it, and apparently it's each of the parts are to represent one of the seas that he had to cross to get to Scotland. And then the jig is a composition by pipe major Donald MacLeod, and it's called Donald Cameron's Powder Horn.
All right, perfect. All right, you've been listening to WRCT. We're coming to the end of this episode of Pandemonium. I've been here speaking and listening to Andrew Carlisle, director of piping here at CMU. And he's got one more piece of music to play, a pibroch, some classical bagpipe music. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this final piece you're going to be doing?
Sure. Well, a pibroch is kind of the classical music for the Great Highland Bagpipe, and it was composed in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. It can be traced back to the 1500s, and it kind of originated on the west coast of the Isle of Skye in a place called Borag by the MacCrimmon family. And so these are very old pieces of music, and it basically consists of a theme, like a melody, and then there's subsequent variations on that melody as you go through the piece. And as you go through the piece, the variations get more technically complex. but they're all based off the original theme. And the piece that I'm going to play is quite a rhythmic piece. It's called The Red Speckled Bull. Now, there's a couple of different stories behind the name. The first is, it's thought to have perhaps been a mistranslation in the Scottish Gaelic, and it was actually supposed to be the Red Speckled Army. So basically the English Redcoats, you know, that they're the Scottish clansmen were witnessing at the time. And the other story about the tune is that, well, bagpipe bags are made of leather, and apparently one of the McCrimmons wrestled a bull and killed the bull and skinned the bull and made his pipe bag out of the skin.
Not sure which story is more brutal.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, this is a long piece, so sit back and relax. You've been listening to the show Pandemonium. This tune's going to finish off the set, so enjoy and have a good rest of the evening. Thank you, Andy.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, rocks. We'll be right back.
Just for you. Oh yeah. And in each room there's so much love that waits on you. To offer you, oh yeah. Behind each door there's someone that really loves you. This house. I'm gonna write a tear-stained letter. I'm gonna mail it straight to you. I'm gonna bring back to your mind what you said about always being true, about our secret hiding places being daily satisfied. I can see you sitting and reading it while you hang your head and cry. I just hope you're not so sad that you're gonna go down suicide. I'm gonna write a tear-stained letter, put it special delivery, 'cause it's gonna be full of stuff that's only known to you and me. About however time I get turned on, you turn me off and bring me down. It'll be about the darkest news that ever did arrive in your hometown. It'll be about the saddest thing your mailman ever did bring around. I'm gonna write a tear-stained letter. I'm gonna tell you one more time that you still could reconsider and come back to be in mine. And if you think about what I'm saying, it'd be hard to refuse. Just be sure you think a long time on the answer that you choose. It will be a most important piece, a personal private news. Tear-stained letter, mark it personal private news, and I hope you'll keep it to yourself and don't go around crying the blues, giving off a bad impression as to what went really wrong.
Hey everyone, you're listening to WRCT 88.3. My name is Ari. I'm going to be hanging out with you for the next hour with Maladaptive Stargazing. The theme for this week is songs for the best Christmas vibe ever. So it's just Christmas music that I love, 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 my favorite Christmas songs. So we're going to get right into it. It should be fun. So, and it's also my last show of the semester, so it should be a really fun time. So let's get it.
Sleep on Christmas Eve. It's time for us.